Good morning and welcome back to Nach Yomi. Today we're going to be learning together Sefer Nehemiah. We're beginning the first perek of our 13 prokim, and it is a short perek. It is only 11 psukim long, and it sets the tone for what is about to unfold. We hear in the first three psukim about how Nehemiah gets news. Let's start at the very beginning. We're told, it is introduced as Divrei Nehemiah ben Chachalia. These are the words of Nehemiah, the son of Chachalia. This is important because, bearing in mind that this is a continuation of the book of Ezra, then in a certain sense, in the middle of the book, there's a chapter heading saying, and this part of Ezra is written by Nehemiah, just to understand why it starts as such. And he describes it in first person. He describes it in the month of Kislev. There's a whole discussion as to when exactly this Kislev was. Was it in spring? A whole interesting discussion. But the important date for us is it's the 20th year. And he describes, it's not a third person description about where he was, but rather, Va'ani, and I, Hayisi b'Shushan HaBira. I was in Susa, which is the capital of the Persian Empire. And he describes how Hanani, which is one of his brothers, arrives and tells him the news. He asks about what the news is of the Jews who are living in the Shvi, in the captivity, who were in the captivity, and about Jerusalem. And he's told, Vayomruli, Hanisharim asher nisharu min ha-Shvi, those who remain as refugees, Bamedina, Bera'ah gedolah uvecherpa. They live in an evil way, in a place of disgrace. And in fact, the walls of Jerusalem are penetrated and the gates are burnt in fire. So it's a very negative report that Nehemiah receives. Let's ask a few questions before going further into the perek. 20 years from when? This is the 20th year. 20th year of what? The Mefarshim explain, the Ibn Ezra as an example explains, this is the 20th year of Artaxerxes, which is understood by Chazal to be Darius the Persian, and therefore, just to put things into perspective, this is now, well actually just before we get there, before getting things into perspective, the Malbim points out that because the two books, Ezra and Nehemiah, really are one book, and in the canon of Tanakh, that is why the Pasuk does not go to further details as to which king it is. Because being as we're continuing to read, and the last king we talked about was Artaxerxes, that being the case, the book did not need to elaborate, explains the Malbim. Let's put this in context. Just to understand a very basic timeline. Again, it's important when learning Sfarim like Daniel, Ezra, and Nehemiah to understand the basic timeline. In the timeline of Chazal, which is the one that we primarily use over here, it's just understand how Seder Olam sets this all up. Let's do a quick recap. Nebuchadnezzar comes to power in the fourth year of Jehoiakim, who is the penultimate king of Yehuda. In the second year, he conquers Jehoiakim and humbles him. And 4 years later, after Jehoiakim rebels again, he is killed 2 years later in a war and is replaced by Jehoiachin, his son, who then goes 3 months later into captivity. So that all happens in the first span of the first years of Nebuchadnezzar. In the 19th year of Nebuchadnezzar, he destroys the Beis Hamikdash and kills Tzidkiyahu, the last king of Yehuda. Okay, so we've had now essentially the of the 45 years of Nebuchadnezzar's rule, in the first year is when he comes to power, of course, and the 19th year is when he destroys the Beis Hamikdash. After 45 years of rule, he is succeeded by his son Evil-Merodach, who rules for 23 years, succeeded by Belshazzar, who is king for 2 years. At which point, when he is assassinated by the Medians and Persians, he is replaced by Darius the Mede. This is the change of empire from the Babylonians to the Persians. If you are counting correctly, then you will notice that this now essentially marks 70 years from the time that Nebuchadnezzar arose to power, this completing the first set of 70 years. However, it is only 52 years from the destruction of the Beis Hamikdash, missing an 18 years still to complete the second set of 70. And so this is just a quick recap of the history of the time. So what happens is in the first year of Cyrus the Great, who becomes the first essential king of this dynasty in Persia, he sets about an edict of return in which he allows the first wave of Aliyah to go to the land of Israel. And that is reversed a few years later by those who are upset, the Sonei Yehuda and the Sarei Yehuda and Binyamin. Then interleading, we have 14 years of Ahasuerus' rule. That's the whole Purim story which goes on. And finally, Darius takes the rule. Darius rules for many years. In the second year, he reallows the Beis Hamikdash to be built, which is completed in the sixth year of Darius, which is And that in the following year, in the seventh year of Darius, we have Ezra being sent to Israel, and this is the 20th year of Darius / Artaxerxes. So if we're thinking about this in terms of the timeline, 70 years from the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, which is the second year of Darius, that's when the Beis HaMikdash starts being rebuilt. So then we have a four-year gap for it being rebuilt. Ezra comes, and 13 years after Ezra comes is when Nehemiah comes as well. That's the general flow of the matter, if we're going to put this all into perspective. Again, noticing, of course, that in the academic or the historical view of, based on the documents of the Persians and the Greeks, and the annals of history, it seems like there's a number of extra years which are had here, a number of extra kings on the Babylonian and on the Persian side. And they would actually put, rather than just being these kings, there's Cyrus the Great for 9 years, Cambyses the Second for 8 years. Then we have Darius for 36 years, Xerxes the First for 21 years, and Artaxerxes was just Ahasuerus, according to Josephus, for 41 years. So there's a longer period of delay in between all of these, which accounts for some of the assimilation into marriage and destruction that we're witnessing. Just to put things into perspective, that's a very, very brief timeline over this. Now, let's understand over here what's going on. When this whole tragedy that's been described to Nehemiah, so he's being told about this according to the way that we're going with Chazal, it's 13 years after Ezra's come up. When did this all happen? When are the walls penetrated? When are the doors and the gates burning down? So the Ralbag explains that this is not something recent. This is something which actually occurred upon the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash. This is what he's describing, is that it still remains in this state, because all they were allowed to build under the edict of Cyrus and then Darius was the actual Beis HaMikdash, not the walls of Jerusalem. So the walls of Jerusalem remain in the destroyed state because of, we'll call it this impasse, this political impasse, because of their surrounding enemies. But Rav Shua points out in his explanation that doesn't make sense, because we're going to see that Nehemiah is going to be very perturbed by this whole experience. If he's very perturbed, it sounds like this was a surprise to him. But the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed now well over 70 years ago. And that being the case, how could he be surprised? So rather, Rav Shua suggests there was a recent attack on Jerusalem by those who were the enemies of the Jews. And that being the case, that's what he's responding to. If that's the case, it raises a few questions, and that is, where was Ezra? Ezra was the ultimate leader, was given, you know, a license to do anything on a legal bearing, so why is it that he doesn't has no power? The Malbim gives us a little bit of a hint, suggesting that there are two groups of Jews. In the first Aliyah, they were under the jurisdiction of the Syrian overlords of the area. The second Aliyah was under Ezra. Perhaps Ezra had limited jurisdiction as well. The Malbim suggests two groups of people. Nonetheless, we now move to Nehemiah's response. What does Nehemiah do upon hearing this news? So he goes into a state of mourning. It's an amazing thing. He talks about how he cries, how he starts fasting. He cries to Hashem day and night. And he turns to Hashem and he says, Hashem Elokei HaShamayim, God of the heavens, HaKel HaGadol HaNoiro HaNoiro Shomer HaBris HaChesed. Hashem, you guard the covenant and kindness to those who love you. How could you allow this to happen? He says, listen to our prayers. What I'm praying to you, I'm going to admit to you all the sins that we did, that I did, that we did, my house did, everybody did to you. We didn't keep your covenant. But Hashem, please remember that you, in the end of the day, you said that even though you're going to spread us among the nations, you'll bring us back. And you allow us to come back, HaKadosh Baruch Hu. These are your servants. These are your people. Please extend yourself to listen to my tefillos, to listen to their tefillos. El tefillas avdecha ve'el tefillas avodecha, to me, to them, hachafetzim liyira es shmecha, who want to fear your name. And he says, and then he asks a last supplication in the 11th and last pasuk. And he says, please, give me mercy, lifnei ha'ish, in front of the man, hazeh, v'ani ha'yisim ashkel ha'melech. And then he says, as an aside, I was the drinks master. What's going on over here? So just a few basic questions. What are the sins that he's referring to? So the Chida points out, if you notice the formulation, it's almost like he's the Kohen Gadol, the high priest. He talks about his sins, his family's sins, and Klal Yisrael's sins. It is an interesting discussion. The Chida himself points out that it may be that he himself does not think himself of guilty of these sins that he's talking about, but he's putting there himself into that in humility as well. You'll notice also similar psukim about the way he describes and he prays to Hashem in the Sefer Daniel, when Daniel reached the end of the first 70 years, and he prays to Hashem, there's no Geula coming. Similarly, Nehemiah seems to be using the same kind of logic and same kind of words, as we see in like Daniel Perek Tes as an example. Who's this man that he is referring to, that please he wants rachamim in front of? The Metzuras David explains that it refers to the king of Persia. And he's explaining himself. He is going to now ask a favor of the king of Persia because he is the drinks master, right? And that being the case, in a certain sense, he is in an Esther-like position. He now has to use his position of authority. He needs to ask and call a favor, which is a very difficult thing to do because specifically as a Jew in this foreign society, one has to display the exactest and most honest of responsibility to their host country. And showing that there's other allegiances is a dangerous thing. So he asks HaKadosh Baruch Hu for mercy in front of this man, like Esther, when she fasted those 3 days before she went to the king Ahasuerus, another Persian king as well. Also, one little interesting snippet which is worthwhile noticing is the Chida points out, quoting the Arizal. Arizal was very want to explain where each neshama comes from. He suggests that the neshama, the soul of Nehemiah, is actually the reincarnated soul of the lost son of David to Bathsheba. When David and Bathsheba had a relationship, they had a child. The child died within the first week, and that being the case, that child, so to speak, where did that neshama go? It went to Nehemiah, which is why, in a certain, he argues, the book does not have the name Nehemiah, because a name has the same gematria as Sefer. Shame and Sefer has the same gematria, and because this child died without a bris, he never actually had a name. Nehemiah, so to speak, has lost that name, but he remains this scion, this prince of the house of David, now reincarnated to create this impact on the nation of Israel. What a remarkable perspective. We see now what he actually does as we start Perek Bez. In the meantime, have a wonderful and meaningful day.